You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is The Brian Callen Show. I am joined by Leo Flowers, the great Leo Flowers.
Yeah.
Comic extraordinaire, D1 football player. He's got a, I'm looking at your skin right now in this light. it's nothing short of caramel. It's like if you took some gold and mixed it with caramel. So congratulations.
No, this is what you get when you get Belizean mixed with a father from Alabama who's
really
dark. So my mom's super light.
Really?
Yeah. And then pops is like black.
black,
man.
Is that right?
It's like he's black.
That's good. Man, you know it's black when you drag it out. Black.
Yeah.
He's not black. He's black. And we're joined by one of my older friends in Los Angeles, the great.
Can we say oldest? When you say older, it makes it like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, like
we're the
90.
Same age. No, we're the same age. In fact, your daughter made a scene at my wedding, and then
That's true. I almost started a fight at your wedding.
Awesome.
Yeah.
His daughter was making noise, and somebody was like, do you mind keeping it down? And Alan was like, why don't you keep it down? They got in a fight in the middle of the speeches. It was beautiful. Alan Barton.
Hello.
Alan Barton, ladies and gentlemen, written a play.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, you were in the... How long were you in the Church of Scientology? Because we're going to be talking about the Church of Scientology and other things. But I'd like to talk about the Church of Scientology. And before we get into this, I just want to be fair to... And you have a very different experience of Scientology. I've known a lot of Scientologists because I was in class for 10 years at least, and the acting school I was in was featured in the book Going Clear. The Pulitzer Prize-winning author Lawrence Wright wrote a book called The Looming Tower and Going Clear, The Prison of Belief. It's basically an expose on Scientology, on the religion. And you are one of the people he interviews in the book.
Yeah, well, I mean, to put context there, you and I were in class together at the Beverly Hills Playhouse, and we were taught by Milton Katselis.
Yes.
And he was a longtime Scientologist and had some notoriety for that reason, and the school had notoriety for that reason, and you probably experienced as much as I did.
Yeah.
Where do you study? Over at the Playhouse. Oh, it's all Scientology.
All Scientology.
Yeah. And
I did I knew Kirstie Alley because I did her show, so we shot in at the Celebrity Center.
Yeah.
I've done benefits. I did a benefit at 9/11, and I was like, I was in a church, didn't realize, and I was swearing and doing all kinds of stuff. And
yeah.
And a bunch of priests from this church came over and go, you're in a church!
Oops.
So there's a lot, people like to make fun of Scientology, but let me just start the debate or just sort of the discussion by saying this. I have met and known a lot of Scientologists like yourself, like Gary Imhoff. And I've had good experiences. And I think any religion, any cult, religion, whatever it might be, look at Islam, look at Christianity, look at Judaism, look at Buddhism, look at Hinduism. My God, there's plenty to take issue with. There's plenty of contradictions. And there's plenty even probably to make fun of. So having said that, let's get into your experience with the church. You've written a play.
Yeah. Yeah, I've written a play called Disconnection, which opens next month with your and my older friend. Let's do older. Makes us smile older than we are.
Is that Jay Hughley?
Jay Hughley.
The great Jay Hughley.
The great Jay Hughley is the lead in the show. So we open next month. And background, like you, I joined the school for its own reasons, mostly because a pretty girl told me to join the school and thought I'd do well in the acting classes
nothing,
there. And I was
nothing
like,
nothing better, man.
I was like, you are really, really pretty. I'm going to do what you say.
I should, just a disclaimer, I should say that I got into two terrible relationships thanks to the Beverly Hills Playhouse.
Yeah, well,
they weren't terrible. They
my wife jokes that we should market it partly for, you know, there are a lot of marriages that have come out of that. There are kids
like the Trader Joe's.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm kidding about the bad relationship. I was the a-hole in the relationship. They were good girls, and they were beautiful.
Yeah, lots of beautiful women. But we were, you know, you and I were both students there, and so it was sort of part of the zeitgeist of the place. You know, like there was this mythology. What is this Scientology thing? What is Milton doing?
And talk a little bit first, before you go into it, we had really famous people in class.
Yeah,
Neil
sure.
Simon would drop in.
Yeah, Neil Simon would drop in because he knew
Giovanni
Milton.
Giovanni Ribisi,
George Clooney, Jim Carrey, Michelle Pfeiffer, now Jorge Garcia. There are a lot of well-known celebrities that have come out of that school.
Yeah. And working
It's a good school. It's been around for 40 years. And I now run it after Milton passed away in 2008. I'm now in charge of that joint. So, but we were there, and I just was curious about it. I didn't know anything about Scientology. I didn't know anything about anything, you know, but I knew I enjoyed Milton and his teaching, and he seemed like a perceptive guy. And I was getting to know people in class that you and I knew, whether it's Catherine Bell or Jenna Elfman, Bodhi Elfman, people who were involved. And I found them to be perfectly delightful, smart, talented people. And because of my connection through Milton, I was able to explore it essentially for free. I never dropped any money over there because, you know, he had a certain number of points. There's kind of a points system. If you have some points, you can give them to other people and they can do stuff over there. So I was able to do coursework over there at CC, Celebrity Center, for free. And I did it mostly just as a curiosity. I wasn't in need of some sort of religious help. I wasn't in a, you know, a lot of people get into any kind of religion, partly from a point of trauma,
yeah,
which is part of what my play talks about. But I never had that. It was more.
I always knew that about you too. You were always such. You were so different than a lot of the Scientologists I knew. It's just you've always been a very solid dude. You went to Harvard and studied what?
Russian history. Yeah,
that's a light subject.
Yeah, light
Russian.
Yeah, just a light. It's a light. Right. It's a light topic.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went in more as the intellectual curiosity. Like, what is this guy talking about? So I read his books and I was like, it's interesting. So they said, well, you could do a course. So I would do a course, and then I did another one. And there was a no cost element, which was attractive. Like, I didn't have to lay out money. If I did, I probably wouldn't have done as much as I did. And then I started becoming known within the community because they have a whole in-house movie studio where they make movies for their own public, you know, to illustrate points of the teaching, whatever. And I would act in those films, and sometimes I would have big parts, and people knew me. And it was kind of in that bubble, I was a celebrity for them. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I went out to the international base out in Hammett, and I met the higher ups and all that stuff. But what the play is called Disconnection, and it's named after the disconnection policy of the church, which is getting a lot of notoriety in recent years, which is if you end up speaking out against the church or do things that they feel are against the tenets of the church, it is required by other members that they, quote, disconnect from you, which is that they cease all communication and just cease their relationship with you. And so after a few years, I was in, to the degree that I was in, which was mostly as an interested spectator, I was in for about 7 years, and I started to hit up against this disconnection policy. It was starting to make its way into the Playhouse life, into Milton's life. They were asking him to disconnect from that person, and I was involved in this because I was helping Milton run the company by that time. And I found this odious and gross and disgusting, and I just kind of stepped away quietly. I was just like, this place isn't for me. I don't like this vibe. It's just not good. And then a couple of years later, in 2003, 2004, disconnection policy was applied to Milton by all of those Scientologist students that you and I liked and admired and had no problem with.
I remember they all literally left the Playhouse.
Yes.
I remember that. Like, everybody was a Scientologist en masse, just left. And
it's en.
En masse. En masse.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to one of the women, who I'll not mention, but I said, what's going on? You know, why are you leaving? She goes, it wouldn't be, and to her credit, she said, I don't want to say because it wouldn't be fair to Milton, and it's my own deal. And
right.
They're very secretive about that.
Yeah. They don't even like to talk about that, that it exists.
Well, disconnect is something that, according to the book that I read,
Lawrence
Wright's book, and who was featured, what is the director's name?
Paul Haggis.
Paul Haggis. Basically, they deny that that is a policy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not to cut you off, but to me, it's interesting how you see that even on a micro level. Like, I remember, like, I was 275 pounds, and when I was losing weight and getting in shape, I lost friends.
Oh, that's interesting.
Like, they disconnected from me because my lifestyle was changing, my ideology was changing, my habits were changing. And when I talk to other people who go through weight loss also, especially if it's a drastic weight loss, they experience the same thing. Like, I think for most people, that's the hardest part, is you lose the social network when you start to
is natural to the human dynamic, which is that people change, you have different points of view, and you maybe lose some friends that, you know, everyone has, like, those people you hung out in your 20s, now in your 30s, and
you don't
hang out with those people anymore. So there's something underneath it which is quite natural, and its prescription within the world of Scientology is that, you know, if someone is messing with you and causing you trouble, a valid handling for that situation is to simply disconnect from that person.
Because they're called a potential trouble source?
Yeah, there's. I don't want to get into the lingo. There's so much lingo. Yeah. But, you know, technically, if you're not doing well, if you're getting sick, if your morale is up and down, if you're having accidents, they say you are PTS, which means you're a potential trouble source, which means you are attached to someone who is suppressive, someone who is a bad person who's out to do you harm. And you can either handle that person or you can disconnect from that person. And either way, you will do better. And you can say that and you go like, oh, well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But then it's also applied sort of proactively to those who then to say, well, the church isn't for me for XYZ reason. And then they go, well, I need to disconnect from you. And then it becomes like, well, your son has now left the church. So you need to disconnect from your son, from your parents. And it becomes a pathology. So you see in the stories that are there in Wright's book and elsewhere, about this disconnection being policy being applied and families are being ripped apart and parents are being ripped apart from kids, all because people maybe don't want to participate in the church and their ideals. So this happened to Milton, and I watched that happen. I was with him through every step of that. And again, I stayed quiet because, look, it was his deal. It was his relationship. And he was friends with Hubbard back in the 60s. It wasn't up to me to speak up and cause trouble for him or make more noise. It was his fight. Mm-hmm. But he passed away in 2008, and I was doing more research. I was starting to read books that were written by former staff members who I knew when I was in. I was like, oh, this guy, Mark Headley, wrote a book. I know Mark. Let me read what he says. He was in the church staff. He was a Sea Org member. Mm-hmm. So I read these books, and I started to be like just horrified by what they were describing in terms of the life that a Sea Org member led. And around somewhere, you know, I started to know more about it. And then Lawrence Wright was writing this book. He called me and said, would you be willing to talk about what happened to Milton? And by then, my voice was getting a little bit more confident and I was more pissed off about it all. And I said, yeah, damn right, I'll sit down and talk about what happened to Milton. Because what happened to Milton was
wrong.
Wrong. And so that my interview is in the book. That earned me my own, as they say, suppressive person declare.
Ooh.
Which is when the church basically writes a piece of paper saying you are now a suppressive person, and now officially anyone involved with the church must disconnect from
you. By the way, just very quickly, I will say, though, that that's a hell of a lot better than a fatwa, where in some sects of Islam and some mosques, they go, they we're going to kill you because you're an infidel.
Well, though, this has been going on. You have the Satanic Voices and Salman Rushdie,
yeah.
And you have...
Look at the Inquisition in Christianity. It was downright violent.
The cartoons of Muhammad, and we're going to blow up your newspaper if you produce... Far more violent manifestations of the same phenomenon. Yeah. But this one, in a way, is... You can see someone who goes like, I'm going to cut your head off if you do that. And you say, hey, wow, that's a bit extreme.
Yeah.
This is a more insidious thing.
Yeah, this is like emotional. Like I feel like this is almost even worse.
Well, it's worse because it has the patina of legitimacy of,
absolutely.
You know, I'm just handling the situation. You don't believe what I believe. And so naturally I should withdraw myself from you so I can pursue my beliefs in a more pure fashion.
But I do think there is a fundamental difference, though, because, I mean, that is maybe hurtful, but it sure as hell is a lot better than getting stabbed to death in the street or have your...
No, there's no question. I think
the difference is one is, you know, other people kill, like you're being killed by other people because you disconnected. And I think that the other one, though, is if your society and your network disconnects from you, you then want to kill yourself because you're lonely. You have nobody to turn to, just depending on how big network is.
I guess what I'm saying is let me give you an example. Like there are a lot of gyms, like martial arts gyms, that if you were to train at another gym after training with them, mm-hmm. those guys wouldn't talk to you. So in some ways, these are...
Yeah, like I said,
human,
it's a manifestation. It's a natural human thing that if you leave this group, we're not going to be cool
Especially,
with you. But when it gets into, well, you need to disconnect from your son. If your son left the gym... And then you said, I can't talk to you because you're at another gym.
Yeah.
Then you start saying, there's something wrong here, which is the tagline for my play, which on the poster says, there is something wrong here.
But what's funny is that there are fathers who say that to their son. If you join this group or you hang out with those people or you go to that school, mm-hmm. you know, then you're no longer my son.
Yeah.
You know? So you even, it's funny how, you know, it just trickles down like that.
Yeah. So what happened after I got my suppressive person declare is something very interesting, which is that my very elderly piano teacher, a man by the name of Mario Fenninger.
Oh, by the way, Alan's a concert pianist. He's literally an incredible... Like,
all right, what don't you do,
level.
Alan? Is that Liz Shorter?
I don't box with Brian.
A high-level piano player can play Rachmaninoff I mean, he's unbelievable. I've gone to 4 of his concerts where he literally can play stuff that takes you a lifetime to learn and understand. But anyway, keep going.
But can you play 50 cents, it's your birthday? That's what's important.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's get to the real stuff.
It's gymnastic.
Let's get to the real
stuff.
It's
gymnastic. Keep going.
So what happened is that Mario, I was helping him out with a situation. I won't go into what it was, but I was helping him out with a certain situation. And then all of a sudden I got a postcard in the mail, an envelope, and inside the envelope was his business card. And on the back of the business card, so you see how big this is, was just a sentence. I can no longer communicate with you, Mario.
Wow. And how long had you known him?
10 years or more.
And he was your piano teacher and he was in the church.
Yeah. Okay. Lifetime member. Long time guy. Legendary guy. And this now, as I said in one of the other interviews I've done about this, I started this journey with Scientology, started out with curiosity. It kind of ended with disdain. Like, yeah, not really for me. See you later. And now I was pissed. And you're a writer. Anger is a really great place to start. Mm-hmm. With an idea, mm-hmm. because it motivates you. It gives you the sense like, I must address this in some way. And I thought it gave me a great sort of emotional hook for a story, because everyone has, not everyone is a classical pianist, but everyone has a teacher. There's a teacher in everyone's life who they have a relationship with, even though years may have gone by, they have a relationship with that person. If someone from outside the relationship said, that has to stop, you would get pissed. And so I realized I had a kind of an emotional hook for a story to tell. Because if you're going to write a play about Scientology and you're just like, it's this, it's that, I don't think that that's very interesting. Yeah. But if you can hit something that the audience will care about, a relationship they care about, and watch that go through the journey, then you've got a good story.
Right.
So that was the start point of the script, which then went through about a year's worth of development over at the Playhouse, where we have our nonprofit theater company, the Skylight Theater Company. They have a whole sort of development program, which I've done for my previous plays. And so it went through the program. We did a series of readings over the last year and a quarter or so. And then finally now we're in pre-production. You know, we're about to go up in a month, and I'm hoping I'm calling it a lit stick of dynamite. I hope it blows things up nicely.
Well, Alan, go ahead.
I'm sorry, buddy.
Not to backtrack, but what was it? Because you said in the beginning you read a series of books that got you interested and curious about Scientology. Mm. What specifically was it about Scientology that lured you in?
It was the people. It was the people I knew. Like, I was studying with Milton, and he was this incredibly perceptive, powerful, smart, charismatic guy. You know, a legendary teacher.
He sure was, by the way.
And then there were...
And he used Scientology. I mean, he talked... I have to say that a lot of the Scientology that I was exposed to in my acting class, I liked a lot of what... a lot of it made sense. For example, and having read the book, boy, what a send-up. I'm not an... David Miscavige, who's the head of the church, is not painted in a very flattering light.
No.
And either is Ron Hubbard. No. Ron Hubbard. But... my experience has always been with some of the basic tenets. What I like about Scientology is take responsibility for yourself. You are responsible for the condition you are in.
Yep.
I like the idea of saying, you know, there's something going on in my life somebody's suppressing me. I'm not being honest with myself or the people around me. That is causing me physical, you know.
And it's particularly
the
case if you're in an artistic field where people are always like, "What is this dream you have? You want to be an actor?" No one, you know. And so artists are particularly susceptible to that kind of influence.
And Scientology is the place where it's celebrated,
and that's
supported.
Why I think Milton talked about you know, the artist. You know, it's hard to use that word without sounding highfalutin, but. The creative person needs to take responsibility for the condition they are in, what they're going to do for their career. Mm. They can't just wait around. And this was a large part of his teaching. It still is part of the teaching over there. We talk a lot about what do actors do to get work in this town and being responsible for the condition they're in and how they're going to change that. So there's a lot of very good things that are not unique to Scientology. I think any philosophy or system of thought that helps people take control of their lives. And Milton certainly was exemplified that. The people around him exemplified that.
But what
we
had actors in the class,
to answer your question. Yeah. There were actors in the class who I was getting to know. They were successful. They were.
Will Smith
they were fun.
Is a Scientologist, right?
Yeah, or but there's always like, is he or isn't he? Because he stays under the radar with it.
But I got from Scientology, and to correct me if I'm wrong, because again, I don't know a lot about it. But one of the things I appreciated about it, in contrast to a lot of other religions, where a lot of other religions start with the idea of faith. You just got to believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, and that makes you a Christian, and we'll go from there.
Yeah. And this point you're making is in my play, because the lead guy, played by our good friend Jay Hughley, says, you know, he has a line where he says, to the degree I never needed religion, I thought to the degree that people were helped by religion, it was because they wanted religion to help them. So that, you know, believe in the word and the word shall be true.
Right.
And Scientology does have a reverse kind of energy at its core, which is that it's only true if you experience it to be true. There was no system of dogma.
Yeah,
and take it on faith, and then it'll be true for you. It was very sort of scientifically, it had a scientific methodology underneath.
Right.
When I was in, it was sort of like I likened it to applying Western engineering to Eastern philosophy.
Well, there you go. I mean, that's what I always gathered, what I had always appreciated about it. I don't know a lot about it, but there were you could take classes, and there were systems in place that you could, there was actually tangible actions you could take,
right,
to get yourself closer to who you wanted to be.
Yes.
And that, so what are the things that you like about the philosophy that you can apply? I mean, there's the tone scale. Some of the things
one of the first things I read in terms of like, well, what is this? Who is this guy? And what is he writing about? He wrote a book called Science of Survival, which was he wrote that after Dianetics. And it alludes to this tone scale that you just talked about. And tone scale is just sort of a scale of human emotions and how one emotion flows to another and how you can then predict human behavior based on an arbitrary scale. For him, it was 0 to 4. Zero being like dead and four being enthusiastic. So I looked at this chart he came up with for, you know, someone who is at 1.1 on the scale, covert hostile. Here's the things that you can predict about their behavior, what they will say, the kind of communications they will forward, what they do. I looked at this chart and I went, holy shit. I can say shit on the podcast, can I? Holy shit. This described to a T a girl I was dating at the time where I was getting my head spun. Could not figure out what was happening to me. And here was this chart down the line. Like, and he has little things like how they handle communication, how they handle their physical possessions, what kind of things they forward, what kind of things they keep secret. This whole thing, he nails it. It was like reading a complete analysis of this girl I was dating. I went, well, this guy knows something about something. The tone scale was by my experience with this girl I was dating at the time, completely and absolutely valid and correct.
And that was
one of the first things that got me in was, right, here's some information. Look at your life. Does it match? Then use it. And if it doesn't, then don't. But for me, it matched totally. I said, well, the guy knows something about something. He definitely knows how people operate. He knows what they're going to do.
And Lawrence Wright in his book talks about that. Say what you will about L. Ron Hubbard. He spent a lifetime really taking a look at what motivates himself, what, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he really did spend a great deal of time. He may have been crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know. But he definitely spent a great deal of time trying to figure out how the brain works.
Yeah, right? No, people say like, oh, he started Scientology on a bet. And someone said, if you want to make $1 million, start a religion. He was like, sounds good to me. But if you look at the guy, wrote 30 million words or something.
Yeah.
I mean, endless books and books and books. And there's there was definitely, I think, a legitimate interest in what makes people tick and how to improve their condition. I just think that he kind of lost it himself along the way and may not have been totally kosher along the way, because there are stories about him being a young man and like his whole life story is a lie. If you read his story versus the books that have been written that look at the documents of his life, he was a first-class liar about his own life from the get-go. Mm. So he's a very, very complex man, but that's not to say that everything he came up with is total shit. Yeah. There's a lot of it that was valid, and certainly when you have an entry point into the church, which is a friend or someone you respect and admire, saying, hey, take this little course, it's 2 days long, and it'll show you about communication or about ethics or about relationships. You go in, you go like, yeah, it's spot on, and where are you? You're in this fabulous building over at Franklin and Bronson. And for me, there was this beautiful piano in the lobby, and it was sitting there unlocked, and they loved me sitting down and playing it for hours on end, and I didn't have a good piano, so I would go there and practice.
Wow.
And so there was, very quickly, it had a very emotional, kind of family-like vibe for me. I went over there, and I was with friends and people who respected me and my talent, and they wanted me to play the piano.
And we should also say that a lot of Scientologists that you meet, and I've met a lot of them, especially in the church, are genuinely good people.
Absolutely. I mean, by and large, these are people who seek self-improvement and seek to help others.
Yeah.
What is corrupt is the management. What is corrupt is how management deals with certain things and how it's been corrupted, a lot would say, under Miscavige's reign, if you want to call it that, since Hubbard died in January 86, Miscavige took over, and that he himself, many would say, is a sociopath who has completely corrupted all of the good values that maybe Hubbard would espouse.
He has corrupted
and made it essentially a petty North Korean dictatorship.
Yeah, people have left. I mean, at least Lawrence Wright's book, I got fascinated with Miscavige and I would love to get him on the podcast because he's very mysterious. Like, he's just not around, right?
Yeah. I have a character in the play, which you would have been great to play, but you don't act anymore. You're just so fancy as a comic. But
hey,
no, I try. You don't come see things. You don't read things. Anyway, you're so funny. You're just so funny,
I'm
and you box.
So funny,
you
box. I box.
And you're just incredible. But
and I'm a liar.
But there's a character in my play.
It should be noted. L. Ron Hubbard may have been a liar. So am I.
And there's a character in my play called The Chairman. You know, the play doesn't mention Scientology, Hubbard, Miscavige, anything, because I wanted the ability to move kind of Scientology adjacent when I needed to for story reasons.
It's an example it can apply to a lot of things.
To free me up as a writer. But there's a character named The Chairman, and he's got one hellacious scene. And you will enjoy watching that scene. The actor we have is quite extraordinary in it.
Have you met him before?
Miscavige?
Yeah.
Yes.
You have?
Yeah. Very, very briefly. Just hello and goodbye.
But
he stays
very much out of the public eye, doesn't he?
Absolutely. He would not. He doesn't really permit himself to interact with the public.
Why is that, do you think? Who
well,
knows?
People, you know, the high-level people who worked for him who have left would say that he is a sociopath and that he has truly become like... you know, the heart of darkness, the guy in the woods, you know, he just has created his own world and has kind of lost control, you know, because there are stories of physical abuse that he doles out and this incredibly foul language he uses and the abusiveness of the staff, locking them up in trailers for days on end. These sort of confessionals, which are right out of the Cultural Revolution, where senior executives need to confess their sins for having fucked up some aspect of what he wanted done.
Kind of Mao's China, Stalin's...
Yeah, it's all that stuff. It's really, really almost operatic in terms of what has gone on, according to people who witnessed it and now are writing books and telling you how it's gone down.
Wow.
And so you have that personality, which one could say is just a more vile version of what Hubbard was able to cover more eloquently with his skill and with his knowledge, now running the church. And you can see that pretty much it's running out of steam. If you really look at the statistics of who's there or who's not there, very few people are going. I mean, no one's going anymore. They're building new buildings, but no one's in them.
You don't hear much about Scientology.
No, I haven't met someone who's gotten in from scratch, like someone who went, I didn't know anything about it. I went over, took a course. It's amazing. I haven't heard that in years.
Yeah.
And so I think they're extracting more and more money and more dedication more feverishly from fewer and fewer people. And that's what's part of this disconnection thing where you must cut off anyone because they're trying to. It's a siege mentality.
Yeah.
And so the people who are in are more and more strident and bitter and nasty about disconnection. And that's why it's become.
Well, they're also, I mean, from what I have read again, and again, I should be fair, I've only read one book on this stuff, and you know, my experience again with Scientologists and Scientology has actually been positive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just has with you and with Gary Imhoff. Gary Imhoff said the greatest thing one time, who was my acting teacher for many years. He said, somebody asked me if I was a Scientologist, and we were talking about prejudice and how we all have prejudice.
This is Gary talking.
Yeah, and you know, as an actor, it's very easy to have human beings are always kind of go, you're a Scientologist, you're a weirdo, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. I never did that, but because I'm a lot like Christ. And
it's so funny because I was just going to say later in the podcast
the
we can get to
but a comedy Christ, like,
but you were talking about
a little more muscular.
But you look. Anyway,
you're like a younger version.
Yeah.
A younger version. Right.
He was still a carpenter.
I work with my hands.
Yeah.
But, you know,
you were talking about Gary.
How are you?
Gary said something really interesting. He said, somebody asked me if I was a Scientologist. And I said, have I taken a lot of courses there? Yes. Have a lot of the courses been no value to me? Yes. Have a lot of the courses been of great value to me? Yes. If that makes me a Scientologist, then so be it.
Well, there's no card. There's
answer.
No membership card. You know, it's not like you sign a piece of paper
But we're talking about management where it, you know, and a lot of management has blown, as they say.
Yep.
And
blown means to have left the organization without approval or authorization.
Yeah. Now they tend to be, in some instances, from what I've read, vindictive.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll try to come after you in one way or another.
Yeah. I mean, just you can YouTube it. You can Google it. Just Google Scientology retribution or anything like that, and you will see videos that people take of the most insane behavior.
Where they follow you around.
They follow you around, and they stick cameras in your face, and they sit outside your house, and they distribute leaflets to your neighborhood saying that you're a child molester.
Jesus.
It's the most vile, vile stuff. And you go, do you realize what light this puts you in? It's absurd, but it's just evil. And so they shoot themselves in the foot with their the vindictiveness. It's become a very nasty, vindictive organization. And even people that you and I probably would have liked and admired, if you saw them now, they wouldn't spit in your face. I would tell you they would spit in my face, quite literally.
Like, besides taking responsibility for your life, what are some of the other like tenets of Scientology that you still take with you? You know,
The way he broke down communication, you know, which can be this topic that we deal with a lot. You're a stand-up comedian. I'm a playwright. You know, you're dealing with how to communicate an idea. And he was able to break that down, you know, into component parts, like that, for instance, not to get too esoteric, but communication is a cause, distance, and effect. So you have a cause point, someone with an idea, you have distance to another person, and you have an effect created on that person. And then you have, before that can take place, you have to have the attention of the other person, you have to do it in a way that they understand it. He just sort of breaks it down in a way where you go like, well, yeah, that totally makes sense. That's what communication is. So there was the studies of that. One of the triangles, you know, they have two triangles that are part of their symbol, and one of them is called ARC, Affinity, Reality, and Communication. Mm-hmm. And in order to have affinity for someone, you have to understand them, which is basically reality. You have to have the same reality, and you have to be able to communicate. And if you are able to look at that triangle and sort of say, well, it's interesting because I actually don't communicate with this person, like my mom or whatever. I don't understand her and we have this problem. But the fact is, I never call the woman and I never write her and I ignore her. No wonder we don't have any affinity and no wonder we don't understand each other.
Like
so maybe if we boost C, we will boost A and we will boost R. And so they have certain ways of breaking it down, normal life things that are just sense. It's easy.
It sounds to me
But this gets, you know, part of why people go crazy about Scientology, you get into the actual auditing procedures where people go back and try to address traumas in their life, and they end up going back to what they are saying are previous lives and previous traumas. That gets into the whole space opera stuff, that there were aliens millions of years ago who came to Earth and did all this stuff, and where people go like, it's crazy. Once you get up to the higher levels of the auditing, there are apparently things you will confront and things
you
that
mean
Hubbard's,
like Jesus raised they'll
say that,
from the dead.
Well, they say that Jesus. That Jesus is an implant, which Jesus was a creation of someone else that was
implanted into humans
to give them something to believe in.
Every religion would match Scientology, I'm sure, in their fantastic.
Yeah, their origins. Genesis, their stories of creation. Yeah. Every religion has kind of a weird stories of creation. I mean, the Mormons. I mean, come on, it's pretty odd.
I mean,
the guy found some stuff in his yard.
Were founded by Joseph Smith was literally a snake oil salesman.
Yeah, and he found some stuff in his yard, and I mean, there's some crazy stories. If you meet Mormons, they're perfectly lovely, responsible, wonderful people who really care about others and spend years of their lives helping others. There's nothing you can argue with that.
But is your problem more with
the creation myth of all religions?
Right. Is your problem more with the management of Scientology or Scientology itself? Because it sounds like
It's tough to say what's what there. Okay. I would say yes. My issue is with management, but Hubbard created all the management policies that are being applied, and now they're being applied in a very, very dangerous and destructive, vindictive fashion. So he says you should disconnect from people who speak out against the church, and it's okay to. You know, there's policy letters where it's okay to lie. It's all, you know, he calls it fair game. It's okay to lie, cheat, steal in the name of protecting the church. Mm. Okay is a sort of a general statement of intent, like you will defend it to the death. Not okay when people take that literally to say, I will lie, cheat, and steal about, for instance, me as a playwright or Lawrence Wright who writes about it or someone else who leaves.
Has Lawrence Wright taken any heat for that book?
I don't know what heat he may personally have taken. They usually spend most of their effort going after former members, particularly former insiders, like people who worked with Miscavige, were inside the church at a management level. If they leave and write a book, those people will be harassed. I have not had any harassment yet for my play, but it may be under their radar. We'll see.
Hmm. I'm just, it's interesting because I keep going back to other religions and what this world is really dealing with. I mean, look at ISIS. you know, you've got these religions that have been around for 1,400 years, and it's, and I guess I'm just, you know, human beings tend to be so damn tribal, and we all want to be right, and you've got, and it, and you know, a lot of religions that have been around a long time just break into sects. There are differences between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. There are differences. I mean, my God, the Catholics and the Protestants fought a 100 years war over...
Well, I
basically,
think, you know, if you look at the world situation like ISIS, I really believe we're in a civilizational religious war, no different from the religious wars of many, many, you know, epochs ago. You know, we're dealing with a corruption of Islamic theology that has turned a certain part of it into a death cult.
Yes.
Now, how do you deal with it? You know, we need someone to rise up. It would be nice to have someone rise up. Like, where are the million men marches to by Muslims to protest the violence of ISIS? This would be a nice development, because then I think you could change it without having to drop bombs on their heads. But in the meantime, we got to kill those people. In my opinion, not to turn the podcast dark.
No.
But you mention ISIS, I say we got to go kill a lot of people, because there's no reasoning
someone
who's going to cut off your head.
I would say, though, here's how I feel about, you know, that situation. Force, we've been applying force to extremists now for, well, at least since 2003. Mm-hmm. We've spent a great deal of money on munitions, and we've killed a whole bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Middle East seems to be a serious cauldron. I become very cynical. I think a lot of the architects of the Iraq War.
Yeah, no, I listened to your podcast. I don't know why. I listened to one where you were the subject. You were being interviewed.
I was?
It was appalling.
Who would want to interview me?
It was an appalling concept. But anyway, I heard your viewpoints about changing the architects of the Iraq War.
I think there are
strategies along the way where you go, like, that was probably a really bad idea, because now it unleashed this, that, and the other thing. And then there's, I'm not going to argue with you about. It's more like, what do we do about the situation now? I don't know that we can just let it
fester. Here's how I feel. I'm actually become quite cynical. I think there were a lot of people that were at the American Enterprise Institute, and people like Richard Pearl, and I want to get these guys.
Pearl and Cheney and all those guys.
Yeah, Michael and Ledeen and those guys.
You want to kill all those guys.
No, I don't. I don't. I think that
you
those
want to
guys,
behead them.
No,
admit
I think
it.
Those
admit
guys
it,
have,
Jesus. Admit it.
I think they have an ideology, and I don't think this applies to Paul Wolfowitz, but Douglas Feith and those guys. I hate to be cynical. I feel like the purpose was to essentially destabilize the Middle East and just leave it be. I feel like that was the idea. Let's just get rid of the threat to American interests, to Israel, to the United States, and to whoever, all our allies, and let's just completely destabilize that part of the world. And I feel like that was sort of, I hate to be cynical, and I'm really going to try to get some of these guys on so I can hear their point of view, because I want to. But
I think they would say that you have to implement a political system, which they were almost pulled off in Iraq. I mean, remember the first Iraq election?
Yeah.
And the cover of Time magazine, or one of those magazines, was a woman in Islamic garb with blue ink on her finger because she had just voted.
Yeah.
And the headline was Bush right? And there was this moment, because they had this election and there was not significant violence, and the whole world took a step. There was like a week there where it was like, oh my, is this gonna work? Are they gonna be able to implement a political system? You know, corrupt because all of them are, and messy because they're not used to it, but is it gonna work? And then by creating a system where people have a stake in the game, a more free market economy, you can start, you know, that I think was what they would say they had to do, is that Islamic extremism was largely born out of poverty and these autocratic, suppressive, horrible, corrupt systems where you had bazillions of youth who had nothing to turn to but the most Wahhabism and Sharia law and all this stuff. And so they were being turned into vipers out of anger and lack of direction and no buy-in to the system. I think Cheney or any of those guys that you say would be like, we have to implement a system where they have some buy-in, where there's a game to play other than violence.
Yeah. Mm. And I would agree with that.
But they misjudged how hard that would be, and they unleashed all these tribal conflicts that have been going on for thousands of years. Iraq wasn't Iraq when it was Iraq.
No,
Iraq
exactly.
was Iraq because it was held together by a madman who would go kill tens of thousands of people if he had to.
That's right.
So it unleashed these tribal things, Sunni versus Shia versus this versus the Kurds and all this stuff that have been sitting there for thousands of years held in place by autocratic murderers. So you get rid of the autocratic murderers and it unleashes this thing, and we didn't control that. And not until 2007 when Petraeus led the surge and kind of
The biggest mistake was probably firing the entire army.
That was probably...
De-bathification was a huge mistake. Yeah, we didn't do that in Germany, In Germany, we fired the first three.
Who was the administrator? Paul, what's his name?
Yeah, but they say Paul Bremer, but it was probably Douglas Feith. And that's where I say...
No, and you can look back and say, that was probably a mistake because you immediately sort of sent off the entire Iraqi military without pay and said, you know, we're going to run it. If you had given them a buy-in to the system, it probably wouldn't have turned out. But this is all, you know, 2020 hindsight.
But they would
say you have to... create a game to play for these people other than violence, and then we dropped it. Now you can say,
but for a second,
you can blame Bush, you can blame Obama, you know, because he said Biden said Iraq is going to be our greatest triumph, and Obama said we're handing over a sovereign and safe and stable Iraq to the Iraqi people. It's time, and clearly it was not time.
Well, ISIS has a great deal of Sunni sympathy. And one of the things that ISIS has been very effective at doing is going into cities, setting up traffic lights, sewage systems, and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why they have so much support. That's why ISIS is a force to truly be reckoned with. Yes, you have sociopaths and do all kinds of stuff. But and you know, they come in and they go, you can either convert or leave.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we're going to kill you either way. But so they've been very effective in how they've taken control. And you could argue that the destabilization of Iraq, of course, made all that possible. You go into Syria, it's a whole different thing. But I thought it was interesting. We all have this compulsion to sort of say, men, I do, and you do. We've talked about this. Bad guys, I want to go over there and kill them. That's how I do things. As I get older now, as I'm starting to talk to more and more people on podcasts and read about these things, force has its place, but man, I don't think it's going to get us out of this situation any more than...
I don't think you can let ISIS take over Baghdad.
No.
And establish a caliphate across half of Syria and most of Iraq.
No,
so then you go, well, how do you stop that conversation? You're going to have to apply some force. And we should have had it there. We should have had 10,000, we should have had a couple platoons on the Syrian border.
Hard power and soft power.
Of course. Of course. But hard power is part of it. And certainly when you have marauding, decapitating madmen, probably hard power is first.
Because we had it. So what's the soft power then?
Diplomacy and getting the tribe, what Petraeus did in 2007, the Sunni awakening, where he got those Western provinces.
John Nagle, who wrote the counterinsurgency manual for the Marines and the Army, who was on this podcast, who went to Oxford, got his PhD, is one of the leaders of thought at the American War College. I believe that's where I think he might even teach there. He wrote a really good book called Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, which is how you fight a counterinsurgency. And he draws distinctions between the way the British put down the Malaysian insurrection, and he contrasts that with the way the Americans tried to put down the Vietnamese insurrection, the Viet Cong. And the Americans did it with big data. You know, you had, I think it was, who was the Secretary of Defense about? How am I blanking on this?
What's his name? They made the movie about him.
Farland? No.
I know what you're talking about.
Anyway, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. I'll remember it. And he was looking at big data, and it was all about jungle stamping. Just bomb the shit out of the enemy over here, blah, blah, blah. And one of the things in looking back on the Iraq War is figuring out a way to get what they call the fence-sitters on your side.
Mm.
Get the general public that are not extremists, who just want a better life for their kids. They just want the lights to run. We all are like that. Most of us are like this. You know, most of us are just, you know, and this is I'm going to bring it back to Scientology in a second, because this is most people who are living their lives just want to be more effective, and they want a better world for everybody, and they certainly want a better world for their kids. And, you know, the bummer about any group, whether it's ISIS, whether it's a martial arts studio, whether it's the cops, anything, any group, whenever you get people, and for that matter, the Church of Scientology, I always feel like the vast majority of the people that are involved, that join, are just trying to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not careful about the way something is structured, if you're not careful about the incentive structures and the way it's structured institutionally.
It's leadership.
But it's also, it's not, you're always going to have bad people in the world. But if you have an institution that rewards and lets the bad people get away with bad behavior, that's what you're going to create.
Mm-hmm.
So it always feels like there's how you organize and how you structure said institution. And maybe there is no structure or organization. Maybe there shouldn't be a hierarchy. I don't know. But that's always what, you know, look at how corrupt the Catholic Church was.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how many priests were molesting children and were, and, you know, look at the cardinals who were protecting these people. And they just went from parish to parish and kept on molesting kids. And this is a matter of record, you know. So a lot of
it's
it is
funny.
Just
I think
taking
about
the task
it,
how something is.
Because when I substituted for, you know, public schools, and sometimes I have like a, I had like 75 to 100 kids in my class, and that's hard to control. And some classes you walk into, and most of the kids are just acting up, you know. And you go, how do you get these? How do, you know, there's a few good kids, and then most of the kids are just wilding out. And you go, how do I? Where do I start? You know.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize if you have a vision, 5, 10 years, you know, down the road of how you want the class to be, and you just slowly implement it, and the kids start to see a benefit from buying into your vision, they slowly turn to your side as opposed to forcing them. It's almost like you said, rewarding the good kids for what they're doing, and then they start to influence the other kids. It's almost, instead of you influencing the bad kids, you influence the good kids and let those kids, once those kids buy in, then they start to influence the other kids.
There you go.
You know, and that's what you have to do, I think, over
you're
there.
You're creating incentives for good behavior.
Right. You're creating incentives for good behavior. But you're also, because when you're an outsider coming in, they already don't like you. No matter, even if you are offering something that's a benefit to them. So if you can get the people who are already on the ground, who are already speaking their language, who already look like them, to then talk to them and persuade them. It, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you're at a bar and you see a hot chick, if you could game up her friend, you have a better chance of then scoring with the chick.
Correct.
Brian
right?
looks, Brian looks so blank right
for
now.
The chick.
No, no, no.
Brian has this blank look on his face.
I've got glasses on this, man.
Brian
yeah.
looks so
it's,
blank. He's married like, with two kids. He doesn't
Brian,
know what
you
were talking about.
You gotta befriend her friends first, and then you get the chick. So it's the same thing. I'm sure that's a crazy analogy for the Middle East, but it's like, you know, we got to make friends with the cool people over there,
and then
get them to spread the word. You know, that's what they do when they come into the hood.
Well, I think
we have a Western point of view on it, that, you know, we have a largely secular society. It's been that way from the get-go, and so politics is the deal. Politics and consensus and economics,
well,
and
rule of law,
property rights, all that stuff was this very specific accumulation of specific things that happened at the founding. That then give us this perspective, you know, and then I think you go over there, you have, again, tribal and religious belief system. So it's less about politics for the country and more about the tribe. I mean, you start out by saying
people are tribal. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so you're dealing with that, and then you're trying to apply a Western sort of like, hey, guys, there's a great system for all of us.
But no, I don't think so, Alan. I think that, in fact, the average Afghani, Iraqi, I don't care who it is. I don't care how remote they are. They all want a say in who governs them. And and if you were to say to them, do you want to live in a society where you can speak your mind or not speak your mind? A lot of them would say yes. Now, you do also have societies, and they've done enough polls where people from conservative societies, let's take Saudi Arabia, let's take wherever it might be, and some of these societies are Islamic, who say, look, yes, I like the things you talk about, free speech, property rights, rule of law. Yes, they're not idiots. They like that. But sometimes they worry about the idea that what are you talking specifically about when it comes to freedom? And they look at our country and they go, well, your family structures suck. You got a terrible drug problem. You've got a huge incarceration problem, many of which are people of color, black and Latino. And there's a growing divide between rich and poor. I mean, so there's a lot to look at in our free societies. And I'm a libertarian, man. You and I are on the same side here on this. But there is a great deal when you look at the United States and you come from a culture like Iraq that is very old. It goes back to Babylon. There is a lot to look at in this country to say, I don't want that. I don't want my kids to look like to be that. I don't want my kids to be spiritually lost. I don't want my kids doing a lot of drugs. Mm-hmm. I travel this country, bro. I'm going to tell you something right now. The United States, we are a nation of alcoholics. Mm-hmm. Holy shit, do we drink. We drink our faces off. Something's going on. There is spiritual poverty in this country of ours.
Pills. I mean, that's the biggest.
It's nuts.
It's insane.
I'm not even a religious dude, man. Right. But I mean, I will say that I think that we have to be careful, and we all do this. We all have to be careful of saying that those people look at life differently than we do. It isn't us versus them mentality.
But isn't that what you just said?
Well, no. What I said is that there are cultural differences which do lend...
Which are often tribal at their root.
At the core, we're all the same.
I don't think anyone on the planet wakes up and says, I don't want a better life for myself today or my kids or to eat well. I think that's a basic human thing. I'm just saying that what then interferes with the known processes for getting there. If you say a system of individual rights, property rights, and a free economy essentially and rule of law will essentially lead you. That's what made America America in 200 years. We're not genetically better than anyone.
No.
That's why people misunderstand American exceptionalism, that concept. They think exceptionalism is an arrogant statement, like we're exceptional people. No, it was the exception to the rule of that time. Property rights, individual rights, freedom of speech, rule of law, and an independent judicial branch and the separation of powers was the exception to the rule of governance for known world history.
Amen.
That's what American exceptionalism is. It's not that we're just awesome people because we're America, which I think is how someone like Obama thinks of it. That's why he puts it down.
Exactly. The Founding Fathers, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. This was the great idea of philosophy because it was so practical and it solved the political problem.
Yeah. 100%. Stemming from the Magna Carta. So you have a system which yielded this superpower status within 200 years, like bang, faster than anything known in the world at that time. So we go, well, that's a system that seems to work. Now, does it have its flaws? Does it have its corruptions? Are people free to drink and do drugs and not go to church and have spiritual vacuity? And people are free to be stupid and be not come to anything. There's that freedom too. But the eternal question is, do you want the freedom, which means the freedom to fuck up, for lack of a better word, or do you want more repressive systems that say we're going to take care of you and provide a certain kind of power? Mussolini, the trains run on time.
For me, obviously, the answer is the first. I mean, I want freedom at all costs. I want people will make mistakes, but I think I believe in maximum personal freedom. You need laws. Somebody emailed me and I get these great emails, and somebody said, I think he might have been a military guy, I can't remember his name, and he said, hey, you want real freedom? You're always harping on freedom. Please, bro, for a second. Real freedom? Because I've had Michael Malice on, who's an anarchist, and Tom Woods, who's a radical libertarian who thinks we should have no government. And this guy, I think he was a military guy, smart guy, goes, hey, tell Tom Woods, Michael Malice, and yourself that when you guys start talking about being radical libertarians, that's what Somalia looks like. Okay? That's basically what Afghanistan looked like, under the Taliban.
You want me on that wall. You need me on that
you
wall.
You need me on that wall.
In places you don't talk about it. Parties.
Exactly. We do need structure. We do need.
Yeah.
Maybe
you do
it's
need
just
force.
How we're implementing it. It's just that thing of like nobody, no matter how bad a situation is, whether we're talking about ourselves or anybody else, change is the hardest thing for anybody. And if you're talking about too many changes at once, there's going to be a rebellion. There's going to be a backlash. It's kind of like you're driving in a car at 100 miles an hour and then you slam on the brakes and you're like, now you can vote. Now you can do this. Now you can, it's like it's it may be too many things at one time. Mm-hmm. You see it even in relationships, people who like you go, why doesn't she just leave him? Why don't they just break up? And it's because it's too many changes. She has to find a new place. She has to get her kid in a new school. Mm-hmm. It's all these different changes. So even if something's better for people, it's really more about like how are we phasing it in? And then how are we educating them? Are we pitching a rosier color to them than it, because if we're going over there and we're just like, hey, if you do this, everything will be great. And it's like, no, it's not. It's going to be really shitty for another 10, 20, 30 years.
Because things take a long time to build.
They take
build.
A long, I mean.
It's a generation.
It's absolutely.
A generation or more.
It's generational.
Huh.
But I think we have to be wary of the moral relativism as it. Like, I got, you know, I almost started a fight at your wedding three nights ago. I was at a 50th birthday party for my sister-in-law, and I'm opposite a guy. We were talking about the Sony thing, and he says, you know what it really is? It's not about cyber terror. It's not about North Korea. It's about American cultural insensitivity.
And
I was tired, man. I was tired. I was afraid. It was like my third party in as many days, and I just went at it. I just went at it with this guy at this long table at a restaurant in Silver Lake, because it was sort of like, well, we have ideas. His point was like, here in the West, we value free speech. But these other cultures, they don't value it. And we have to respect that. That was sort of his point. And, and thus, we should never have made this movie that would offend the great North Korean
dictator. I wish
I'd
been there. I would have been right behind you going, shut up. Alan, tell him, shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
Pick up a history book, dummy.
And so I said, so what is the means by which you would affect this cultural change?
Because would you have a panel? Would you have a cultural sensitivity board?
Well, what I said was, because I think a minister of culture might be a good idea based on where, because I think Stalin had one. I think Hitler had one. I'm sure Kim Jong-il has one. Kim Jong-un. And so what is the means? What is the mechanism that would have prevented Sony from making a stupid movie about the death of Kim Jong-un?
The Minister of Culture.
You're satirizing. And I said, I'm not satirizing. I want to know what this thing you want to put in place is that would stop Sony from making a silly movie. Because would we have stopped Team America World Police, which actually is a really funny, good, clever satire.
Yes, it is.
Which also
makes fun of Kim Jong-il.
Yeah. So the moral relativism is a danger where it's just like, well, one value is the same as another value. It just depends on who holds it. And ISIS, you know, I joked, I said, yeah, we have this quaint cultural moor in the West. We like our heads attached to our shoulders. And in ISIS, they just, you know, they don't value that as much. And we have to respect that. You know, and I'm going, no.
Right.
We do not have to respect that. Otherwise,
there are,
you know,
all bets are off after certain people commit certain behaviors, right?
I mean, yeah.
If you kill people to get your point across, all bets are off.
Yeah.
And that's the point. If you do bad things to people.
And fortunately, you know, not trying to sort of in a clumsy way bring it back to our initial topic, because Scientology and even the management of Scientology is not evil in that way. They're not going to cut off your heads and they don't come and kill you. That's not the danger. But there's a whole scale of activity, like what you just said, doing bad things. What is that? What is that? It's sort of like, who's that Supreme Court justice? I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
What is this bad thing? And do we know it when we see it, or can it be legitimized in some way? We are just enforcing a policy of the church that those who speak out against it must be shunned. And this is a normal policy of many churches over time. And people are free to make this choice or not make this choice. You know, and they cover it with this sheen of legitimacy.
I don't mind that. What I have a problem with is if they come after somebody and ruin their reputation.
Yeah, or harass them or go through their trash.
That's where I have a problem. If that is so, and I have no proof of it, I've read these things. Mm-hmm. But I don't like to indict anybody until I've seen it. Then it's a different story. But for me, you know, the disconnect policy is something that I wouldn't do. But I'm not as bothered by that. I guess. But first of all, It hasn't been done to me. It hasn't been done to you. But
it's been done to me.
Yeah.
That's why I'm writing about it.
Right. And
but the thing is, it could be done, and sometimes you're not even aware of it. You know, you just go, the phone stopped ringing.
There's the Facebook police. They have the Facebook police. Your friends start dropping you. It happened to me.
But at least in a way, that is, let's just say the Church of Scientology has a policy of disconnection. At least that is, you know, if they turn their back on you, that is a nonviolent way of saying I disapprove and I'm just not going to have any communication with you. Now, it may be hurtful and things like that, but man, I will take that any day over what a lot of other people have done in the name of other religions. I guess that's kind of what I'm saying.
Right, absolutely.
And even if there are elements in the Church of Scientology that go through your trash and all that, my feeling again is that's probably at the behest of one dude, whoever that might be, and that's a group of soldiers.
There's a very interesting question, which is how does this end?
Yeah.
This guy is not going to live forever. He's still young. He's in his 50s, I think. But how's it going to end? You know, there are all these sort of talks like, is he just going to have a heart attack one day and that's it? And then what happens? Or is he going to go Jim Jones, you know, Heart of Darkness? Is he going to go that way? Mm-hmm. Is he just going to disappear to a non-extraditable country with about $100 million in cash? What's how does this end? Because I do think a lot of the destructiveness and is coming from the pathology of one person. But it's the pathology of one person using a philosophy and
resources
and millions of pages of policy letters and stuff written by Hubbard, who was himself an extremely interesting and flawed individual. I have in my play a sort of creation of what he might be thinking at his the moment he checks out.
What's the name
January.
Of the play? It's called Disconnect?
The play is called Disconnection.
Disconnection.
And
where is it playing?
We're opening at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. We preview January 16th, open the 24th. And it's produced by the Skylight Theater Company, which is our affiliated theater company there at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. So, I'm really looking forward to it because I think it's a play that's about something. A lot of people write about Scientology and they send it up. They do cute skits about Tom Cruise. This, to me, what I hope is that it's a real serious look at a serious problem. I agree with you. It's definitely a first world problem.
Yeah.
You know, your trash being gone through, your friends disconnecting from you, your family's being ripped apart. This is a first world problem, but it doesn't make it any less impactful to those who live in the first world than the more violent aspects of religious extremism as they apply to other parts of the world. Mm. So I think it's going to have some impact.
Good.
I think it's going
to
do
and
something.
And there's a standing invite to anybody from the Church of Scientology, including David Miscavige, if he wants to come on this podcast. I would love to interview any of them. You're welcome to and come and speak your mind and say your piece. Because I'm fascinated with all those things. I think, obviously, and I think there has been, as you would probably agree, people get a lot from various religions. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that have benefited a great deal from Scientology, as you have. But then there's that other issue that you have to deal with. So
yeah, and eventually you have to speak out.
I like that we live in a country, by the way, where you can write a play about that and speak your mind.
Yeah, and people have gotten a little soft about what a privilege that is. And that
the
freedom to be able to do that has a lot of blood spilled that we are not used to. And that worries me, not to then prolong our podcast.
No, I
think you're drawing to a close, but it worries me because we have many now generations of people who do not know what the price is.
I agree with
for
you, man.
Freedom.
And so
are they then willing to pay the price when it's under attack? Mm-hmm. Which I think the Sony thing is catching so much attention is that it speaks to something that underneath we're like, who's going to fight? You know, let's say there's this army. It's going to come down from Van Nuys. It's coming over the hill. Who's going to fight?
Mm-hmm.
Who do you know who's going to stand up and fight for the ideals of this country and that, you know, and how many people are going to say.
A country defines itself on what it's willing to fight.
And how
for.
Many people are going to say, well, they just have a thing that they're passionate about and they should be heard and they should be listened to as a tank runs over your head. So there are a lot of timeless stories, good and bad, that are touched by disconnection policy or touched by ISIS. And I'm not trying to draw a comparison of magnitude between disconnection and decapitation. There's a difference in magnitude for sure.
Turning your back on someone.
But here we are in a privileged Western society. You know, I talk to the actors a lot when I teach. I say, you know, they complain about this. They complain about their agents. They complain about casting directors. They complain about whatever. And I say, listen to you. You are here sitting in a nice air-conditioned theater in Beverly Hills, California, where you have the immense privilege of pursuing the aesthetics as your profession. You want to get paid a lot of money to tell stories. What a privilege this is. And here you are bitching about your agent. Can we have some perspective?
100%.
And I think the Western world is at risk for having lost the perspective because the blood spilt feels like long ago.
I
and,
like it.
And
love
feels
it.
Maybe.
Alan Barton, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Alan Barton. Well
I gotta
said.
Go see it.
Smart guy.
Wicked
guy.
Smart,
He's
as they say in Boston.
Russian history.
Wicked.
Ooh. Disconnected.
I grew up outside Boston. Wicked smart.
Wicked smart. He went to Harvard.
Barton, you're going to Harvard. Do my homework for me. Not coming to my play. You have not seen anything
Even
I've done.
Even if I have to walk through all
years.
The picketers, all the Scientology picketers, I will walk through. And by the way, you know me. I'll be like, hey, guys, listen, I think you're all really nice. I'm just going to see the play. I've never had anything but positive experiences with all my Scientology friends.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You
moral relativist.
I know.
At heart.
Yes,
the play Disconnection, Beverly Hills Playhouse, coming to you in January.
There it is.
Pleasure talking with you. It's good to see you. I haven't seen you in a couple years.
The same, don't I? Haven't aged a bit. Still got it. The kids still, they call me the kid.
No.
Still
no,
look
that's
like
not
Christ.
That's not true. No, you look older.
Damn it.
Weaker.
Weaker too.
Flaccid. Flaccid. Is the word flaccid?
Come on, man.
Wow.
I'll show you my boxing video.
Yeah, it's a little flaccid, but it's good because you're
look
like 50.
Very good when I hit mitts in my
No, because you're 52, you're 53.
Said, I'm 47.
You're 53. And
I play 38.
Pretty exact.
I get nervous now when I go out for auditions. The guy in his 30s, I'm like, all right, here goes nothing.
You've had that feeling now.
I kill the audition and I don't hear back.
Do you have the impression that this happens to me a lot now where you're in a room and all of a sudden it comes to you? I am the oldest person in this room.
Oh, yeah, man.
It's like,
oh, yeah. Yes, believe me.
Ah, the uncomfortable moments. Like, when did I become the guy with three kids?
Now I can't see in the dark. It's really bad. My feet hurt when I wake up. I'm still live like a cat.
Yeah.
And if you want to see me in person, January 8th, 9th, and 10th, I'm at Laugh Boston doing stand-up comedy. And then I'm in Fort Lauderdale with my boy Leo Flowers. Are you coming to Boston with me?
Nah, Florida.
How come you're not coming to Boston?
Cold.
Why? I don't know. All
right,
January.
I'm gonna get
Boston?
On the phone.
You said they had the guy already.
Oh yeah, Boston's local. They got a lot of local.
Yeah, they got their local guy.
That's right.
They got their guys.
They
over
got a lot
there.
Of great local.
They're tribal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Leo Flowers and I will be in Fort Lauderdale, January 28th, 29th, 30th, something like that.
That last weekend.
30th, 31st. It's going to be fun, man. I love that room, bro. Wait till you see that room.
I'm looking forward to it.
Woo! That is my favorite room on the planet. We are going to pack it in. It is. I want to shoot my next special there. I said it out loud. There.
Wow.
Bro, it's sick. It is sick. I love that Latin vibe. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been everything.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.